This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. County Extension Director Bobby Lewis Sibley says the Unity Community Center in Normal has had a big impact in the last 15 years.
Since Unity Community Center has been open, the Normal Police says the teen crime rate around this area has dropped significantly.
You'll get a report on expansion plans at the Unity Center. Plus, a Bloomington Normal expert on childhood trauma talks about potential long-term effects of the Trump administration policy separating children from parents in immigration detention. And John Norton has the music of Kyle Yap. All that in a GLT news update coming up. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Over the past 15 years, the Unity Community Center in Normal has done big things, and the Multicultural Center is about to get even bigger thanks to an upcoming expansion project. On Tuesday morning at the Unity Community Center, a room full of kids wasn't staring at their phones or getting into trouble. They were working in teams in a race to put together a 100-piece puzzle.
40 seconds.
Oh!
Are we under a time limit?
No.
Oh, so we're just...
Oh, okay. Now I get it.
Next up was some time in the garden. It's all part of the Unity Community Center's summer camp, one of the many services provided here on Orlando Avenue in Normal. Anna Bursa from Bloomington is a teen teacher at Unity. She creates lesson plans for the summer camp. This week's theme was civic engagement.
I just really like interacting with the kids, and I want to become a teacher in the future, so it really gives me a lot of good experience, and I really love the community service that comes along with it and just everything that Unity Community Center does.
Anna is excited about Unity's upcoming expansion.
Honestly, it's great because the Unity Community Center, they do so much outside of youth programs, like helping the surrounding area, and I think that expanding that and getting more resources and getting more funding for that is so great.
I visited Unity this week to talk about the expansion with Bobby Lewis Sibley, the County Extension Director for Livingston, McLean, and Woodford counties.
We took over some space vacated by the Town of Normal Police Substation, and we're going to adjoin that space with our current space and renovate it and put in a commercial kitchen.
Why now? Why was this the moment to do this?
One, it was a perfect time because Normal vacated the premises, or they're part of the building, and we do have funds available through two of our grants to take over that lease. And it's a perfect timing as well with our kitchen because we need to address some issues there. We do have a food permit, but we're only currently using microwaves, and it would be wonderful to have a range and a stove and a dishwasher so we can reduce our carbon footprint.
Yeah, we'll get into the food later, which is, I know, a big part of this. But I want to ask first about the having more space for teen programming. Can you talk about how much more space you'll have and what that could mean for the impact you'll be making?
Sure, absolutely. The room we're sitting in right now is we call the library, but you can see that also there are four large cubicles for the staff, and those will actually be removed and be put in the new space. And so that will free up all this space in this room for teen programming.
What would that actually look like, having these spaces back and more space to work with?
We go by the positive youth development model, and so we will incorporate the teens' input and feedback into what those programs are going to be. So at the start of the new year, the Unity staff will work with the teens to see what that's going to look like. It could be anywhere from having another music class in here, specifically for kids, for teens. It could be a specific teen spaces where they can have some downtime separate from the younger kids here. So really, we're going to incorporate what the teens want to do with this space.
Currently with teens, what are some of the current teen programs that exist here?
Well, right now is a perfect time to talk about what's happening at summer camp this week at Unity. And the junior high youth are here, and they're doing a civic engagement camp this week. So it's all about how to be a productive member of society and be engaged in your community. And so they went to ISU yesterday, and they'll be at ISU today at their community engagement department doing things with them.
Can you go one level deeper on the summer camp and the civic engagement types of activities? What are some very specific things that they're doing over the course of these 6 to 8 weeks?
Well, one of the things that they're doing that is they're going to be building a My Free Little Library here. They're going to build two of them. And so it's just a way that the youth can be part of something, building something that will help the neighborhood and community. So there'll be one in our garden, in our children's garden out back, and there'll be one out front. So anybody from the community can come and pick up a book and take it and read.
What kind of role do you think the Unity Community Center plays in our community in terms of keeping teens out of trouble?
Well, the primary reason why Unity Community Center got started 15 years ago was because of the high juvenile crime rate in this area around Orlando Avenue. Since Unity Community Center's been open these past 15 years, the Norman Police Department says the teen crime rate around this area has dropped significantly. So it's just not what we think, but there's actually research and numbers behind the fact that the teen juvenile crime rate around here has dropped. So Unity Community Center plays a very important role in that.
This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. I'm joined by Bobby Lewis Sibley, County Director of University Illinois Extension, serving Livingston, McLean, and Woodford counties. We're sitting inside the Unity Community Center here in Normal on Orlando Avenue. So, Bobby, what will this expansion mean for your ability to serve after-school meals for kids?
We serve 5 meals a week for 9 months out of the year to 50 kids, and that's quite the undertaking. And what's even more significant is the same two women have been cooking those meals for 15 years for us. And what that means for us is that currently we only have a microwave, 2 microwaves. The expansion for the commercial kitchen will include a range and stovetop and a dishwasher, because currently we have no way to wash dishes. Even though we have a sink, it's for prep and not for washing dishes, which is completely separate things. So this will mean that we can reduce our carbon footprint and actually have real dishes and silverware and not rely on paper products and things like that.
How do those two women react who've been cooking here for 15 years when you told them you don't have to use a microwave anymore, you're going to have a real kitchen?
They actually have been, you know, I wouldn't say hounding is the word, but they've actually been advocating for the kitchen for probably the last 7 years that I've worked here. So when I told them that what was happening, they were more than ecstatic. So it will be a wonderful thing for them and for the kids, because we can then serve different types of foods too.
Are there any other aspects of the expansion that you want to get into? So we've talked about the teen program side. We've talked about the way it's going to improve your ability to serve meals to kids. Any other piece of it that you wanted to get into?
Two other pieces. One is we have a large production garden here at Unity, and so the youth know where their food comes from, and it's not always a can. And so having the commercial kitchen will actually help that as well, so we can, you know, utilize the food that we grow here with what we serve the kids. The other thing is that we have a nutrition and wellness program as well, and I have a registered dietitian on staff. And so her ability to use that commercial kitchen to teach community people as well is another aspect of that will be very important for the community. The other thing is we are moving our SNAP Ed community worker to this building, so that we have all those staff who really focus on that low income target audience all in one building. And so that way that services are more seamless.
And what is SNAP Ed?
The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, it's a federal grant, and so this individual goes to schools who have high free and reduced lunch youth, and also like Heartland Head Start and other adult audiences too, and they just discuss ways to be more healthy in both exercise and what they eat.
And you mentioned Unity has been around now for about 15 years. So how many kids do you serve on an annual basis?
Well, Unity Community Center is a little different than other youth organizations that have after-school programs, because we are not a drop-in and drop-off. All the youth who are signed up for Unity participate every day. So we have the same youth. And every semester, we serve about 50 youth. So that's about 100 for the school year. And then during the summer, we have about 6 to 8 weeks of summer camp. And those camps range from anywhere from 15 kids a week to about 25.
And what is your mix of funding here for the Unity Community Center?
It is a mix between State Farm Foundation grant, Town of Normal HUD grant, and then county dollars and state and federal dollars.
And today you have a Midwest food bank operation going on in here. Explain what I'm seeing here on the table.
So University of Illinois Extension is very, one of our priorities is food access and food insecurity. And so one of the things that Unity Community Center does is we are a space for Midwest Food Bank for a donation site for food. And so every Tuesday and Thursday, we open our doors to the community around the Unity Community Center. Our staff go and get food from Midwest and bring it back, and then families come and pick it up. We estimate, because we do sign-in sheets, that we that food every week serves approximately 150 people.
That's County Extension Director Bobby Lewis-Sibley speaking about expansion plans the Unity Community Center in Normal. This is GLT's Sound Ideas.
Support for GLT comes from Westminster Village, serving the retirement needs of individuals with a continuum of care from independent and assisted living apartments to short and long-term skilled nursing care, all on the same comfortable campus. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. A Bloomington Normal expert on childhood abuse says there's hope for traumatized children who are being separated from their parents at the U.S.-Mexico border. GLT's Eric Stock talks with Lisa Piper, Regional Vice President of Children's Home and Aid in Bloomington, who says healing often goes on for years.
We know that it's traumatic for children to be separated from their parents. We've learned that in the field of social work. And we know the trauma that it causes the children, and we also know if that does have to happen, if children have to be separated from their parents, we know how to do it to try and minimize the trauma as much as possible. So it just makes me think and hope that folks are, you know, following those lessons and doing things in a way that mitigates the trauma rather than exacerbates it.
So what are some of those tips to minimize?
Sure, absolutely. What we've learned is that, of course, the younger the child, the harder it is. The trauma for them, because they can't process what's happening to them, they don't have the language skills yet. So lots of physical reassurances to those children. You don't want to necessarily change their environment. You know, don't take the clothes off them that they've been wearing, or take their favorite little blankie, even if it might be dirty or a little bit tattered. So we've learned that kids who do have to be separated from their parents do better if they can stay together with their siblings. That really helps mitigate the trauma. If they can possibly stay with an adult that they know and have a relationship with, that mitigates the trauma. If they can have visits, regular visits that they can count on with their parents while they're separated, that helps mitigate the trauma. And these are all lessons that we've learned in the Illinois child welfare system with kids who come into foster care.
Now, you had said the younger they are, the more traumatic it is. Is there a cutoff, though? Can they be too young to even be aware of what's going on around them?
Very young children are still going to experience a sense of loss. It's going to be different for them. They can't put it into words. I mean, these are kids who sleep may have, then their sleep's disrupted, their appetite's disrupted. And they can't ask questions, and they can't process. If somebody says, oh, you'll get to see mommy and daddy on Thursday, or you'll get to see your big brother and big sister tomorrow, we're going to have a visit, that baby is not going to understand. And so what do babies do when they're upset and they're a little discombobulated? They cry a lot. They fuss. They don't sleep well. And little children can experience trauma. It's just different from them. I mean, imagine what an 11-day-old and an 11-week-old and an 11-month-old and then an 11-year-old child. Each one of those children is going to experience trauma as a result of being separated from their family, but it's going to be different given where they are developmentally.
And what is the likelihood that that trauma stays with them long term? And does that depend also on the age in which they're experiencing this?
It depends on a lot of different factors. I have to believe as a social work professional that it can be better. A lot of the programs that we have here at Children's Home and Aid are put in place to help kids heal from trauma. And we see children heal every day. Again, if you mitigate the trauma in the beginning as much as possible, and then you offer supportive services, whether that's play therapy, or there's an awesome therapeutic modality out there called TheraPlay that actually helps a child and caregiver bond and attachment, that can be especially helpful for a child that's being cared for by a quote-unquote stranger, you know, someone that they don't know. So absolutely there are ways to mitigate the trauma. There are ways to help the child heal. Will the child be impacted? Yes. Does that mean doom and gloom forever? No. It just means, though, that there's some work that needs to be done to make sure that it isn't doom and gloom.
As someone who has been watching this, I gather, over the past couple of days, the situation that has unfolded along the border, how confident are you that these children are getting any sort of care along those lines to make sure that they are not traumatized?
I don't think that's a question I'm probably competent to answer. I would hope that, you know, that we have learned our lessons over the last 40 plus years in the child welfare system, and that folks have paid attention and taken that information to heart and understand that, okay, separations, when they do have to happen, they can be scary, they can be traumatic, but there are things we can do to make them better. I mean, I fervently hope that that's the case.
Does it matter what the nature of the separation is about for a child who is old enough to understand it to some extent? Parents go away sometimes because of divorce, or if there is an accident, a parent goes away to jail or something along those lines. This different from all of those. Can a child who's a little bit older understand that, and does that impact how they respond?
Separation is separation, and a child who's not able to be with their parents, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say they're not going to really care why. They're just going to know that mom and dad are gone or their siblings are gone, and all of a sudden they're alone. How that came to be is not going to matter quite so much. And why I say that, what we found in the child welfare system, even children who are abused and neglected and have to be taken away from their biological parents because of that abuse and neglect, those children don't ever say, thank you for getting me out of that horrible home where those people were hurting me. They're upset. They miss their mom and dad. They just want, you know, that abuse and neglect to stop. They don't want to be separated from their family. So kids just know that mom and dad aren't there. And why, it doesn't really matter to them. My guess is going to be they're probably hoping that the grown-ups involved in their lives are figuring that out and are looking out for them.
And so when you see the images on TV, what's the first thing that comes to mind?
I've really tried to stay away from some of what's going on with the media. I worry about any child and separation. My almost 4-year-old grandson goes to our daycare center, and his favorite teacher in the whole world is out for 2 days because she's helping a relative with actually a great thing. A relative had twins, so she's helping. But all he knows is Miss Caitlin, his favorite teacher in the world, wasn't there this morning, and he didn't want me to leave him. And this is our daycare center here, where he knows I'm right across the parking lot, and he's been coming here for his whole life. So it was still, I don't want to say traumatic and make Miss Caitlin feel bad, because of course, you know, she should have her day off to help her family. But I really try not to get sucked down that rabbit hole of watching, because it's just, and you don't know if what you're seeing is representative of everything that's happening, or, you know, things being taken out of context. So, you know, I'm just doing a lot of hoping for the best at this point.
That was Lisa Piper of Children's Home and Aid in Bloomington with GLT's Eric Stock. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. All great-looking landscaping has one thing in common: accurate and adequate water. During this edition of GLT's gardening program, Grow, Mike McCurdy talks with ISU's Patrick Murphy about how to automate watering.
You may have noticed this spring was dry and hot. That meant dedicated gardeners were checking the forecast for the next rainfall and watering a lot. But you could make regular and precise watering easier with a little more upfront work. I'm Mike McCurdy. This is GLT's Grow, your source for practical gardening advice from our expert Patrick Murphy from Illinois State University School of Biological Sciences and the curator of the Fell Arboretum. Murph, thanks for stopping by.
Thank you, Mike.
There are different brands, different types. There's direct drip, sprinklers. I was just at a big box store the other day and was looking sort of in awe at a shelf full of all kinds of irrigation, home do-it-yourself irrigation kits, and there's all kinds of information there, different varieties. You have to pay attention to the gallons per hour for the plant, whether you want a sprinkler or drip, as I mentioned. I didn't even know where to start. So where do you start?
Well, let's start by saying that we're not going to use this DIY system to water our lawns. This is primarily for ground level planting beds, hanging baskets, containerized gardens that are either on the ground or on a back porch or a balcony. And regardless of the one that you choose, they are all powered by a hose bib or a silcock that's on the outside of a home or a small business.
So you don't need a plumber necessarily.
You don't need a plumber, and you don't even really need a toolbox. For the majority of this equipment, the tubing is like around a half-inch flexible plastic tubing, and you make the cuts on the tubing with a pair of household scissors or a really not a sharp pocket knife or something like that. There is a brand out of all of them that's my favorite, and I've been using it for over 20 years, and that's Mr. Landscaper, and I think it was one of the first. And the reason, Mike, that I love it is because their hardware, the elbows, the tees, the splitters, all that stuff, it's a friction lock. So you could just have a damp rag or do the old-fashioned grandpa trick and spit on one end of it, and then you twist and push, and that locks the bushing onto the plastic tube. And after that is done, you're finished as far as connecting your elbows and tees and things like that.
Is the amount of water each plant or recommendations for the amount of water that gets dropped on a plant in the instructions in these kits?
It's not. And you'll be hard-pressed to find a specific reference that'll tell you plant A needs this much water.
Because the irrigation kits will say, well, this will drop this much water in this amount of time.
Yes.
So how do you know what to do there?
Well, that has some influence on why I have a favorite. And the Mr. Landscaper heads, the emitters, all different kinds, whether it's a drencher, you know, that just kind of bubbles water, or they have a general purpose head, which is a great one that's on a little soil spike. It's righty-tighty, lefty-loosey, so you can increase or decrease the amount of water at the emitter without having to do any kind of strange plumbing back between the pot and the source.
Or by a different emitter.
Or
all the emitters are adjustable on this particular brand.
They are.
So if it looks like it's getting too much water, you can back it off. If it's not getting enough water, you can increase the amount of water with this particular brand.
Correct, Mike.
So is there a minimum water pressure you need to have coming out of the house before this would work? Is that something you need to get tested, or is that...
I don't think so. And the reason I don't believe that's the case is because the system that I like, the Mr. Landscaper kits, they are self-sealed and self-draining. So when a little bit of pressure builds up in the line, it seals the connection where the little feeder lines branch off from the main half-inch tube line. And then on the other side of that coin, when the system is done, all of the water runs out of it through that fitting that is no longer watertight because there's no pressure. And I'm very confident that they'll work with meager pressure because I've seen many places where there were two hose bibs running at the same time, one in the front of the house, for example, and one in the back. And it might take longer, and that's something that you might frankly want to avoid is, you know, have one system run while the other one is sitting still if you had that scenario. If there's enough water pressure for it to eject water from a garden hose, there's ample water for the ample pressure to fill the tubing.
And what's the goal here? Making sure the plants get adequate water, a water saving so you're not overwatering, maybe time for the gardener,
yes,
time savings?
Yes, and yes. And definitely on the water savings thing, because it'd be really easy to set this system up and walk away from it without making any adjustments. So at the last step, I would think, and for anyone setting this system up, is to make sure that the emitters are set correctly. So let's talk about the emitters for a second. Some of the emitters spray a pattern that's like a 360-degree, like, fine spray. Not a mist, but a fine spray with small droplets. Then there are other emitters that shoot the water out in a rectangular pattern left and right of the head. So if you had a trough-style planter, you could water it with one head. And then there are other ones that emit a very fine mist, similar to what you see in Arizona or Texas in outdoor air conditioning, that fine of a mist. Even if you choose the different heads for different size pots and different size spaces in your ground plots, you still have the privilege of reducing the output or maxing it out. And that's something that might change during the year also as the plants grow in and there's more foliage, you need more water. And early on when you're just getting started and you're getting the help of cool nights and a rainy season, you could dial it back.
So at the spigot, I would imagine that's where the whole system gets its water from. You could have a splitter at the spigot so you could still get water off of that. On the other side, a timer that would be hooked to that maybe?
That's right. Melnor, Rainbird, and some other commercial landscapers like Toro and John Deere Landscapes, all of these companies make what's called a automated valve timer. And it's about the size of a hardball or a baseball, and it screws right onto the silk hock or the hose bib. And then you might need an anti-siphon piece to prevent any water from going in. And then your tubing and your connections, they usually run off either two A or AA batteries or one 9-volt battery. And the water would remain on, and the water would be turned on and off with the automated valve timer.
So on at the spigot, but the timer actually controls whether the system is getting its water or not.
Exactly, yes.
And you said no turf. Why aren't we watering turf? I know it takes a lot of water.
Yeah, watering turf is something that these systems are just not equipped for. They don't hold the volume of water. They don't relocate the water adequately. And this is a system that consists of basically black plastic tubing and black surgical tubing. So that would kind of get in the way if it was resting on the ground. Mm-hmm. So, and it's too small of a tube and such to bury it in the earth because it would fill with soil particles and clog quickly.
As with just about anything in the garden, there is some maintenance involved, especially before the first freeze, I would guess.
Yeah, you would want to, you don't need to remove this stuff or put it away in the winter. You just need to disconnect it from the water. And it drains empty when it's not on. So when that valve timer shuts off,
you don't need to blow it out with an air compressor or anything.
No, it just drains empty. So you're not wasting any of that water. It's going into the landscaping. So I think that the maintenance would be more during the growing season. So you're gonna have a level of output during the spring, increase during the summer, and maybe back off during the fall. And then another caveat on the valve timers, Mike, is you could program it for multiple waterings during the day. So if you wanted to do your primary watering when you're having coffee and getting ready for work in the morning, you could have it come on real briefly to kind of knock the heat down sometime during the high sun hours.
Okay, if you have any questions about irrigation or anything in the garden, you can submit them at wglt.org/grow. And Patrick Murphy with ISU's School of Biological Sciences will give a pretty good shot at answering your questions.
We'd love to get those questions.
Next week, we'll talk about living outside. And before we can do that, we need furniture and outdoor decor. I'm guessing we'll talk about durability.
We need to talk about that.
Okay, that's Patrick Murphy. I'm Mike McCurdy. Send your gardening questions to wglt.org/grow.
Murph says irrigation systems can also be used with vegetable gardens since the pieces are modular and can be changed out from year to year. You can find past episodes of Grow at wglt.org or subscribe to the weekly Grow podcast at our website or your favorite podcast app.
You may have noticed we stepped up our online game. The judges for the Illinois Associated Press Awards noticed too, recognizing GLT for best digital presence in the state. And they said they like how our stories and interviews are easy to find and how photos are well connected to local stories and that our website is a one-stop shop. GLT News is on air and online at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. This is the award-winning GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.
Support for GLT comes from Cefcu, partnering with car dealers throughout central Illinois to make the auto loan process quick and convenient. Competitive rates for qualified buyers. Online pre-approval is available. Cefcu, not a bank, better. Details at cefcu.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Amid the news of high-profile celebrities taking their own lives, the CDC reports suicide rates have gone up across the U.S. Since 1999, Illinois has seen a 23% increase. Chicago author Kelly Klink tried to kill herself when she was 16, and several years later, her younger brother Matt died by his own hand. IPR reporter Maureen McKinney talks with Klink about the ways suicide has touched her life. Klink's memoir, published in 2015, is called A Different Kind of Same.
I didn't start out being open about it. I was very ashamed after I made a suicide attempt, and I didn't talk about it with my friends. I actually went all the way into college and was dating someone and got married, and I didn't even tell him about it for about 7 years. But after I lost my younger brother to suicide, I realized that not talking about it with him, not talking about it in our family, not talking about it with my friends in my community, was actually dangerous. My brother was someone who didn't speak about his mental health at all and did not reach out. And I think that was one of the main contributors to his suicide. So I felt like it became very important for me to change that.
I wonder, was the recent news of celebrity suicides troubling for you?
It's really interesting. I talk about suicide a lot. I write about suicide a lot. I would say I'm way more comfortable with it than most people. And what I found to be surprising for me with the recent news about Kate Spade and Anthony Bourdain was that they were where they were in their lives in middle age. They had children, they had families, they had successful careers. I didn't realize that actually middle age is the highest risk for suicide. So I was, you know, it was difficult for me to read about that because I had sort of been thinking that my highest risk age, that I had already passed it. I thought, oh, I'm out of adolescence. You know, I'm established in my life. The worst is behind me. And then I thought, okay, no, I really need to continue to be vigilant about my mental health. And this is something that we as a country should probably talk about a lot more. And prevention efforts should be focused more on people in middle age because the risk is actually greater.
I think it was a shock for a lot of people. And the news came out right around then that the suicide rate in the country has been on the rise. Do you have a sense of why that might be?
I can only speak from my personal experiences. And for me, I find that to be surprising because I felt that overall as a country, we seemed like we were moving more towards an acceptance of vulnerability. Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on, but I'm definitely with everyone else in that I'm glad that we're talking about it. I hope we continue to talk about it. I hope it doesn't take more law for us to keep talking about it and to keep working toward some kind of helpful solution.
Would it be all right for me to ask you a little bit more about your mental health history?
Of course.
Please tell me.
So, I mean, I think my family history has some mental illness in it. It wasn't something that was talked about, so I didn't really know. I had the sense of that everybody else was okay, and that when, you know, I was hitting my teen years and having depression and having anxiety, that there was just me. And then it was my brother, too, and I thought, well, I guess it's just us. Like, maybe we're some kind of bad combination of my parents' genes. So yeah, when I was 15 years old, my family moved across the country, and that's when I, you know, had my first major depression. And my brother was actually diagnosed with bipolar disorders. We found out later that, you know, there was a lot of depression on my mother's side of the family and some obsessive compulsive disorders, some eating disorders, a little bit of depression on my father's side of the family too, some addiction, some alcoholism. I think the stuff is in most families, honestly, but it just wasn't talked about at all in our family.
What made you decide to write about it?
I think ever since I was a little kid, books were like a refuge for me. And I was always like a very anxious child. And, you know, I had like the, I was really sensitive. I really leaned on books a lot. And as I got older, I leaned on writing. I did a lot of journaling. I wrote a lot of angsty teenage poetry. And it was kind of my dream always to write a book. But then I have degrees in literature, and I just thought, well, I'll be a teacher or something. And I never thought I would have anything to write about. And then after my brother died, I couldn't talk about it. I didn't talk about it at all for like 2 years. I just kind of lived my life and pretended like everything was okay when I could, and would like just fall apart privately. And finally, I had to get it out of me. And writing, it felt like a place where I could put everything down without fear of like judgment. I had control. I had control over the narrative. And then it became really therapeutic for me. And it was a way to sort of get some distance and some objectivity in my grief. I think the bigger decision was like to try and make it into a book that other people would read someday was kind of, that was a bigger decision. And it was something I felt like I had been silent about my mental health for so long. I had been silent about my suicide attempt for so long. My brother had been silent, and it had caused him to take his own life. And I felt the best way, the easiest way for me to break that silence was going to be to write a book. I think for anyone out there who is feeling suicidal, I think my message for you would be there's nothing wrong with what you're feeling. There's nothing wrong, inherently wrong, with those thoughts or those feelings. There's nothing wrong with you. I've been on both sides of this, right? I've had those feelings, and then I've been on the side with the loss, and it's just devastating. And I would encourage anyone out there who's feeling suicidal to, you know, please take and get whatever help you can to try and stay, because wherever you're at right now will pass. It is not, everything changes. It always changes. And I know this because I've lived with depression and suicidality for over 20 years. And it honestly, I feel like it's gotten easier for me because I come out on the other side, and I know when it happens again that it's not permanent, and that there are things I can do to get through the tough period. For a family of someone, for a family who's lost someone to suicide, first I can tell you, you are not alone. There are so very many people whose lives have been touched by suicide. So please don't be afraid to talk about your loss. Don't be afraid to ask friends and family for help. Don't be afraid to tell people what you need. There's no wrong way to grieve. You might be really angry. That's totally fine. Everything is fine. Everything's allowed. And it will get better. That's the thing that I can promise you. You can recover from this kind of loss. And it takes a lot of time, but it's possible, and there's a community here for you.
That was Chicago author Kelly Klink. Her book is called A Different Kind of Same. She spoke with IPR's Maureen McKinney. The number for the crisis hotline in McLean County is 211. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. From a young age, Bloomington singer-songwriter Kyle Yap says he immersed himself in his father's classic rock LP collection. Yap is one of 70-plus musicians performing this Saturday during the Make Music Normal Festival in Uptown. He tells GLT's John Norton that Steely Dan and especially the Eagles informed his current style of play.
Always a big fan of pretty much all their guitar players, the harmonized solos and, you know, the epic songs, and then their pop rock songs like the Take It Easy, the big hits and stuff like that. I play a lot of those as part of my staples in my regular sets.
How did you come to play, to present the music the way you do? Why aren't you a punker? Why aren't you a metalhead? You know, why are you like, you are like kind of right down that Eagles, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, right? That kind of sound?
Absolutely. So that's kind of where that's what I play predominantly, that kind of style. But it's funny you should bring up punk and metal, because when I first started playing guitar at the age of 13, I was all about punk rock. And then I started taking guitar lessons, and my guitar teacher, Aaron Tappan, he had me playing Pantera, Metallica, just a lot of hard rock riffs and stuff like that. And that's where, you know, a teenage boy, 13 to 15 years old, really wants the loud volume and, you know, the high energy music and then the guitar solos and everything like that. That's, I'm a big fan of that stuff, but I don't really get to put it in a whole lot into my live show just because, you know, it's acoustically for the most part. I do have a little drum machine that I play with and a looper. So sometimes it can sound like a full band, even though it's just myself.
Is it a money thing?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, because it definitely pays the bills when you can walk into pretty much any bar in, you know, I play all over the Midwest, so pretty much any bar, what I typically do is look at the average age of the crowd and kind of play music that I think that they probably grew up with. I like to bring them back a little bit. So if I walk into a certain venue, say like Dr. McKay's, where it's a pretty, it's, you know, East Side bar in Bloomington, a lot of just working folk that'll come in and, you know, try to unwind. And most of them are going to be in their 40s. Most of them are going to be in their 50s, somewhere in that range. You might have a few younger people. So occasionally I'll throw in the 90s rock songs, but a lot of times it'll be, you know, 20 years ago when they were, you know, in college, they were probably listening to maybe it's Stone Temple Pilots,
sure,
maybe it's
Pearl
Poison.
Jammer, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much anything. So I like to read the crowd, and then, you know, if there's a couple outliers, like a 22-year-old, you know, in a bar that's filled with 40-year-olds, then I'll play some a little bit more modern stuff. But typically it's average age of the crowd and then stick with that. And then, you know, the crowd will react to different songs differently. So if they start really liking an Eagles tune, I'm going to make sure I remember three songs from now. I'm going to play another Eagles tune and, you know, maybe do one of the more out there songs. Maybe that not generally one of the top 40 hits that at the time, just but a little bit more deep cuts too. So I play a wide range of stuff. I probably know about 500, maybe even 1,000 songs off the top of my head.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Oh my God. That's quite a feat.
Yeah, and
I
know
that. Like a jazz musician, you know that.
I did play jazz band in high school as well, so okay. I'm pretty wide range, and I credit that to Randy Huberman, was the jazz band instructor at Central Catholic, where the high school that I went to, award winning jazz program. The music program as a whole was really good, and he really got me out of my comfort shell. So if I was playing, you know, distorted rock, three chord punk songs, I'd have to show up to jazz band at 7:10 in the morning and start playing in an A minor 7 flat 9 and stuff like that. So a little bit more of the, I don't know if you want to, just the dense chordings and stuff. But that, I try to incorporate that a little bit even into my music, even though it's a little bit more poppy Americana. I still kind of throw those dense chords in there every once in a while.
Well, you brought your guitar with you.
I did.
Can we get you to play it just a little bit?
Absolutely.
Okay. All right. What do you want to play? Are you going to play your own? Are you going to play an Eagles song?
This will be one of mine. This is probably one of my favorites. So I always kind of give the same spiel every time I get up in front of a crowd to play this song. So this is about a terrible, terrible human being. I just happen to call her my ex-girlfriend. So this is a song called Chisel Away. You know, you're in a relationship. You know, you go back and forth. And sometimes you just kind of get numb to it. So I called this song Chisel Away, like chisel away at my stone cold heart. So now it's gotten to that point.
Okay.
I've been careless with a lover, so now she's gone and found another. So I'll just sit and drink my whiskey, 'cause I know she don't miss me. But chisel away in a stone cold heart, chisel away, but you won't get far. 'Cause I left her cold, battered and bruised, and she ain't got no love for you. Now so chisel away, chisel away, chisel away.
Yay, I like that.
Thank you much.
It's an original. Kyle Absolutely. Yap is our guest here on GLT Sound Ideas, one of the many performers at Make Music Normal this coming weekend in Uptown Normal. Well, let's switch gears. You and we were talking off air about you playing with Dan Hubbard for a number of years.
Absolutely. And when I was 21, I went to the beer fest, the Brugula. I don't remember what it was called at the time, but out at the Interstate Center. And my brother went to Central Catholic and Dan went to U-High. So they had kind of known each other for years, and then went to that first show and was just really impressed. Americana sound, singer-songwriter, a lot of originals, great tunes, good voice. The band as a whole was pretty great. And then went to see them at another show, and the guitar player at the time ended up walking off stage in the middle of a set. I think he was just maybe just a little too inebriated at the point. And his wife had known I was a guitar player, so she pretty much told me, get up there and, you know, play a couple songs. So played a real simple song in A major, and, you know, it went really well. The crowd was digging it. So a couple weeks later, I think I joined the band and kind of took that guitar player's place. But
So you literally sat in with Dan that night? You got up
that night, yep.
Wow, that's gutsy.
I've been playing since I was 13, so at the time it was, you know, 8 years in, and, you know, when you're in your in that age, I think you're kind of have a little bit of liquid courage in you sometimes. So I don't know if it was necessarily bravery as it was just kind of inhibitions out the window. Just go ahead and get up there.
Well, when Dan disbanded the Humidors a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. I mean, is that why you're not in the band anymore?
The band kind of just, I feel like we had a lot of momentum, and then kind of stalled a little bit, and then, you know, creative differences and just different periods of life. I mean, he's just a few years older than me, but it makes a big difference sometimes, because I was still in my early 20s.
Had you been playing under your own name at all outside of playing with the Humidors?
Yeah. So once I turned 21, my first gig was actually at the Grand Cafe, the old building that's now just kind of sitting there on Route 9. But that was my first gig, and I'd been playing pretty much 100 gigs a year since then, since I was 21. And now it's actually getting, you know, your name gets out there, you get a couple more weddings or a couple more anniversary and birthday parties and private parties. So I probably play an average of about 120 shows a year. And last year was probably my best. I played close to 150.
Wow, you're staying busy.
So every Friday, Saturday, and then a couple Tuesdays, Sundays, anything like that.
Kyle Yap is the voice you're hearing on GLT Sound Ideas, one of the many voices you're going to hear this weekend at Make Music Normal in Uptown. You're still holding that guitar tightly. You want to play another cut?
Sure, yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So here's a song I wrote for my wife, actually. This is kind of one of the more introspective ones that's a little bit more recent. This is a song called Take Me Down.
So take me down, baby, give me the good night. Come on down, come on into the moonlight. Let's hit the town, drink to the sunshine. Let me drown in your red wine. Baby, I don't need no fancy cars. I'd rather play this old guitar. I watch you watching me all day long. We don't need no lottery, just as long as you're with me. But a couple of $100 and I won't complain. You got everything I need, now I've got you up to speed. Let's take your time as we go slow. I remember yesterday, but I think I'd rather contemplate spending 50 years right here with you. So take me down, baby, give me the good night. Now come on down, come on into the moonlight. Let's hit the town, drink to the sunshine. Let me drown in your red wine.
Oh, man, I love that.
Thank you very much.
That is fantastic. Kyle Yap is who you're listening to on GLT Sound Ideas. He's part of Make Music Normal this weekend in Uptown. I'm going to follow up with that, okay?
So, absolutely.
So you write really melodic songs. Where does the ability to be able to write a catchy song come from? Is it just listening to that classic rock you were growing up with and it gets
bit.
In? Or do you hear things in your head?
So part of it is just hearing it in your head, but I listen to so many different styles of music, from country, pop, rock, jazz, funk. So I listen to a little bit of everything, and I just feel like I can try to incorporate as much of those little vocal melodies as you kind of can, the ones that are super catchy. Part of it is just the, you know, growing up in the 90s, you know, those songs, the alternative rock songs that you would hear, all of them had really good melodies. And lyrical content. So that's one of the things I've been trying to do, is just make something catchy. And there's a famous producer, I can't remember what his name was, but every song has to have three hooks in it. So whether it be a guitar lick or a line of a chorus, you can talk about like Michael Jackson's, the Jackson 5's ABC, like the Mama's gonna teach you how to get an A. That's just kind of one of those little na 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 na.
So that's one melody.
Yep. So that's probably, and then the A, B, C. Pretty much as soon as you hear that, you know exactly who it is, what style it is. It's just one of those catchy licks that you try to find in every song.
Well, Kai Yop, it's great to have you in studio.
Thank you very much.
I know a lot of folks. Yeah, looking forward to seeing you at Make Music Normal, one of the many artists performing this weekend. You got one more song in you?
I do. This is a song called Four More Chords. This is actually written in... it was written in Dan Hubbard's house at the time. So this is probably a 10-year-old song, but this is one that's been a favorite of a lot of my friends and fans. So here's Four More Chords.
That's Bloomington's Kyle Yap speaking with GLT's John Norton. Yap and over 70 other musicians perform at 8 different venues this weekend at the Make Music Normal Festival in Uptown. The original song you're hearing right now from Yap is titled Four More Chords. You can discover more local music and hear from artists playing in Central Illinois and the GLT Music Podcast. Find it on NPR One or your favorite podcast app.
I don't want you back if your mockingbird refuses to shine. When summer's here, we're flicking cigarettes up at the stars. I don't really know why, but never got that far. The girl is empty, she's got nothing left to lose. And I've got a scissors to make and love that I don't choose. So
here's a thanks for choosing Sound Ideas and WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories, with help today from Eric Stock and John Norton. WGLT.org is also the place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One.
I don't want you back if your mockingbird refuses to shine. So how much longer till Chicago comes on? Louisville, my darling, I just can't leave you.
This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. Bloomington Normal's Public Media.